I'm Steve Hayward, and this is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Jaffray, and we're talking about childhood. We speak with Professor Stephen Mintz from the University of Texas about the history of childhood from the colonial era to the present day.
Our image of children and childhood as a period of carefree innocence is a relatively recent historical invention.
We talked to Dr. C.J. Pascoe about bullying in the 21st century.
I did ethnography for about a year and a half at a high school in Northern California, and I heard the word fag so much.
We visit the Fountain Valley School to attend the Mile High Speed Cubing Tournament.
So it's all about coming in and making things the same color as fast as you can.
Professor George Butte fills us in on the unlikely history of Peter Pan.
Peter, is, in the original, is quite heartless. He's a deeply narcissistic character, quite cold at heart.
And Dr. Nick Santilli describes a new developmental stage, emerging adulthood.
The period of 18 to 25 in most westernized or industrial cultures is still a period of time of prolonged transition to full-fledged adulthood.
Stay with us.
Professor Stillman had come to think of the parents he encountered each afternoon in the parking lot of his children's school as a street gang from a black and white movie. Not so much as parents, but as the parents, a leather-jacketed group of overgrown juvenile delinquents who showed up each day looking for trouble. Like the West Side Story, only without the singing and without the West Side. Mostly Stillman kept to himself, but this week he'd been the subject of unwanted scrutiny after Mrs. Parker, the kindergarten teacher, had been overheard referring to him as Dr. Stillman. Doctor, said Jenna, who Stillman considered to be the ringleader of the parents. She was the mother of twins, which conferred on her a kind of authority. I didn't know you were a doctor, she told Stillman. I don't believe it, said Iwana, in her somewhat sexy James Bond villain accent. She was the mother of two and had emigrated the previous year with her husband from some undisclosed location in Eastern Europe. They were both engineers and worked for the same defense contracting firm. Maybe you only tell people you're the doctor. I'm not an actual doctor, Stillman admitted. I'm a professor of English. And so you get called doctor, said Ellen. She was the mother of Megan. Since when do they call professors doctors? I think that's kind of misleading. People could get the wrong idea. It's not safe. It's Doctor of Philosophy, actually, said Stillman. Doctor of Philosophy, snorted Tim, who was actually a doctor, an obstetrician on the West Side. I think that's ironic. The topic in the schoolyard last Wednesday was the note that had gone home the day before. It had threatened to mark all students as tardy who were not actually sitting in their desks by 7:50 a.m. The school day begins at 10 to 8, the note warned, and lateness would not be tolerated. The morning before, the note went on to say, some 167 out of 250 students had been marked late. This would have to change. If parents could not get their children to school on time, more severe penalties would follow. If most of the kids are late, are they actually late? Asked Tim. I mean, isn't this America? I thought we lived in a democracy. The thing is, said Jenna, I have to make two lunches in the morning. It doesn't matter what they have in the cafeteria. Jane and Jim want peanut butter. So does Megan, said Ellen. It's the only thing she'll eat. The other night, I made spaghetti just for her, and she threw it on the ground, so I gave her peanut butter. What can you make for the lunch that isn't the peanut butter, said Iwana. Do they want me to wake up in the morning and cook the chicken to make the chicken salad sandwich? Who has time to make the chicken salad, said Ellen. Does she want to make the sushi to make the chef come to my house, said Iwana. Back in Romania, if you had the peanut butter, you'd have the big celebration. Well, said Moira, that's communism for you. This whole drama of getting to school on time, said Debbie. I could do without it. The bell should ring at 8, said Jenna. There you are. Problem solved. I mean, said Tim, don't we live in America? I'm going to say something, announced Jenna. Just tell the principal we've had enough, said Ellen. Tell her if you crush the people for so long, said Iwana, it's only so much time before they take it back. Maybe don't put it exactly like that, said Professor Stillman. And all at once, it seemed to him that he'd become their leader. He didn't know how it had happened, only that it had. He tried desperately to think of something to say. Maybe he'd invoke Thoreau, perhaps the storming of the Bastille, perhaps even speak in French. But then the bell rang. Instead of the confrontation he had been bracing for, the parents simply took their children and headed out towards the parking lot. Stillman didn't know where they were going, only that they were going somewhere. They seemed to have somewhere to go. Stillman pretended to do the same. So, Stillman asked his son in the car, how was school? School was school, his son replied. Is that a good thing? Professor Stillman wanted to know. School was school was school was school, explained his daughter, then turned and stared out the car window as if she considered the topic closed. This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. Steve, this week we're talking about childhood, which seems like it should be a very simple thing to discuss. But as we know, in American culture today, the whole concept of childhood is something that's really fraught with contradiction and with an awful lot of anxiety, it seems.
I think we wonder if we're doing it right. I know that as a parent, I wonder if I'm making the right decisions, if I'm producing the right kind of childhood for my children.
And it seems that not only do parents wonder about whether I'm doing it right myself, but there's an awful lot of animosity out there in the popular culture about are other parents doing it right with their kids, too. It seems there's the mommy wars, for example, have heated up about what is the right way to raise your children. And everybody pretty much better be on board or the vitriol comes out.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. You know, when I think back about one of the memories that I have from my own childhood is of a mercury thermometer breaking in our kitchen. I don't remember exactly the circumstances, whether it was my younger brother biting clean through it or whether it was some other kind of unfortunate incident that happened. But I have this very clear, almost visceral memory of getting down and playing with the unusual mercury.
This explains so much.
It's not the kind of experience that you would put into what to expect when you're expecting into some kind of parenting manual. On the other hand, that kind of freedom, that kind of sense of experiment, that's really foundational in terms of thinking about my own childhood.
Right. And so I think that malleability, the way that childhood has changed and developed and morphed over time, is one of the key features here. We talked to Professor Stephen Mintz at the University of Texas, who's the author of Huck's Raft, about the history of childhood and how childhood has changed, starting from the Puritan era in the United States and going through the present day.
It's interesting to me that our image of children and childhood as a period of carefree innocence is a relatively recent historical invention. The Puritans would have disagreed with everything about that conception. They believed that children were innately sinful, that they were animalistic, and they needed to grow up as quickly as possible, where we try to preserve childhood dependence as long as we possibly can.
So how did the Puritans do things like parenting? I'm imagining that they weren't all about letting the children explore their creativity in a free and open manner.
The Puritan expectation was that children would contribute to their family's well-being, and that meant work. And that was particularly true for girls who were put to work at an early age, spinning and sewing and engaging in a whole variety of tasks in addition to child care.
Where did children's education fit into the scheme of things?
Children did attend schools. There were what were called dame schools for very young children, which would teach reading and writing, but which were also sort of daycare centers. For more advanced education, that was left entirely to boys. And so it's really shocking to us to discover the low levels of female literacy in the 17th and early 18th centuries, and then how dramatically that changes at the beginning of the 19th century, when, especially in New England and the middle states, virtually 100% of women can read and write.
So tell me what causes that change. What makes things start to happen at the beginning of the 19th century?
The crucial change in attitudes takes place at the very end of the 18th century, the very beginning of the 19th century, when more and more parents embraced the ideas of John Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. They saw children as highly malleable creatures who could be shaped for good or ill. And that placed enormous burden on child rearing.
Now, tell me about child labor, because I've seen, the photographs of child laborers in the southern cotton mills and coal mines and things until very late in the 20th century, it seems to me. Tell me about the history of child labor in the United States.
Even though middle-class urban parents took their children out of the labor force beginning in the early 19th century, child labor persisted in this country, and it took a 40-year-long battle in order to relegate child labor to the dustpan of history. Parents put their children to work not because they were heartless, but because children's labor was absolutely indispensable to a family's well-being. That is, children under the age of 15 generally contributed about 20% of their family's working class family's income. And of course, in farm households, it was just taken for granted that children would be involved in work. Now, as I said, it took a prolonged battle to end child labor, but in the end, it was really other factors that brought child labor to an end. Compulsory schooling was extremely important, and technological innovations that made child labor less productive or unnecessary were also crucial.
So it seems you're talking here that there are two sides of this. One is a cultural conception of childhood, and the other is public policy. Can you talk about how those two pieces fit together to make this change?
Modern childhood is very much shaped by public policy. And once again, it was reformers who played a crucial role in this, people who called themselves child savers. You know, as early as the 1820s or 1830s, an urban middle-class childhood would have looked recognizable to you and me. That is, children would stay with their family of birth until the age of 18 or even longer, and they would attend school. But most children's experience was anything but like that. As recently as 1900, most kids who entered school would be out of school before the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
What the child savers wanted to do was to universalize a middle-class conception of childhood. And what's extraordinary is that they succeeded in doing this. A key step in that process, beginning in the early 20th century, was the development of the modern high school. This country opened a new high school every day for 30 years.
Wow.
And this dramatically changed young people's experience. It was aided in one of the ironies of history by the Great Depression. There was enormous pressure from adults to get kids out of the workforce. And this meant that a separate youth culture could emerge, a peer culture could emerge, separate and apart from adult supervision. And of course, that's the young people's culture that we live in today.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about this, the real change that happens in the 20th century. The Great Depression is part of it. I think World War II and the post-World War II consumer culture is part of it. How does childhood really dramatically develop during the 20th century?
One development that few of us think of when we think of childhood is the development of what I'll call age consciousness. We are highly attuned to how old people are, And further, we use age as a key sorting mechanism in our society. If you're 6 years old, you're in one grade, and if you're 12 years old, you're in another grade. This growing age consciousness, which was then institutionalized by schools, has had really profound consequences for the lives of children who have far less contact with adults than their counterparts would have in the 19th century or the 18th century or the 17th century. A second development is the radical redirection of both our popular culture and our material culture surrounding children. By the middle of the 20th century, advertisers and marketers had discovered a true youth audience, and they began to target their advertising directly at kids. The other side of this is the growth of mass popular culture, which also became increasingly directed towards kids themselves. So instead of sharing in a common culture with their parents, children's broadcasting, children's music, children's books are targeted exclusively at a juvenile audience.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Giffray. We're talking to Professor Stephen Mintz, the author of Huck's Raft. So, Steve, one of the things we see is that this youth peer culture is really a relatively recent development. It's something that only emerged in the 20th century, that idea that kids, teenagers, would have a space that was their own, that was really separate from the rest of society.
And when we think of teenagers, we think of high school. And when we think of high school, we think of all the awfulness of high school. We think of alienation. We think of the existential crises.
We think of acne.
Exactly. We spoke to C.J. Pascoe, author of Dude, You're a Fag, about exactly these kinds of issues, about the ways in which youth culture today is affecting the way we conceptualize childhood. Why don't we start by having you say a little bit about the title of one of your books, Dude, You're a Fag. Where does that come from?
Right. It's a kind of jarring title.
A little jarring.
Yeah, a little jarring. Makes people feel a little off-put when they have to say it. And I did that on purpose. And I didn't just sort of come up with it out of nowhere. When I was researching that book, I hung out with, what sociologists call doing ethnography. I did ethnography with high school boys for about a year and a half at a high school in Northern California. And I heard the word fag so much, I simply couldn't avoid it. It was like a verbal popcorn when I was walking around the school. It would simply appear out of nowhere, seemingly apropos of nothing. And that phrase, dude, you're a fag, came out of their mouths repeatedly. And eventually I began to sort of think about the role of homophobia in how boys came to think of themselves as men and as masculine, and I realized that's it. That's what they're doing when they're calling each other this awful word, right? And so the boys would often ask me, well, what are you going to call that book? And I'd look at them and say, dude, you're a fag. And they'd say, oh, yeah, that's great. We say that all the time. I think what it captured was their sort of daily lived experience at school. You know, when you say that word, it doesn't feel good, right? And when people hear that word, it doesn't feel good. And I encourage people to sit with that because that's what boys hear on a daily basis at school. In fact, about 80% of kids hear homophobic slurs on a daily basis.
And 80%?
Mm-hmm, 80%.
Wow.
Right?
And why is homophobia in particular so salient for these kids in ways that, say, racism or classism or sexism maybe aren't as much?
That is a great question, actually, and it's something I think a lot about because this was the sort of primary insult that I heard when I spent time with these kids were these homophobic insults and largely employed by boys and directed at other boys. And most of the boys who were on the receiving ends of these epithets identified as straight. So I asked them about it. You know, why do you use this word all the time? And they would tell me things like, it's the worst thing you can call someone. One boy told me, it's like saying you're nothing. right? So it literally obliterated you as a human being. What those sort of homophobic epithets do is they function as a sort of shorthand to tell for boys to tell each other how to be a man, right? You need to be strong. You need to be competent. You need to be heterosexual. You need to be dominant. And those are all the things they would tell me that they meant when they said, dude, you're a fag. Right. So these same kids that I would talk to who would say who would easily call another boy a homophobic epithet would also say, oh, I'd never call an actual gay guy that. That's mean. Right. Or they'd say things like, oh, yeah, gay guys should totally get married. Right. I just don't want to marry one, but they totally should be able to. So you've got on the one hand decreasing levels of homophobia and on the other hand, increasing levels of what we might think of as a gendered homophobia.
Right. Right.
Right. A way in which this type of homophobic language functions to sort of remind boys how to be masculine.
We're speaking with Dr. C.J. Pasco, author of Dude, You're a Fag, about bullying and high school culture. Stay with us.
Steve Hayward, and this is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. We're talking with Dr. C.J. Pasco about the time she spent doing ethnography amongst high school students in the United States and investigating high school culture, especially around the issue of bullying. Dr. Pasco, it must have been very difficult for you to be in the high school, be immersed in this situation, and actually witness acts of bullying on a daily basis.
There was one kid who was the target of
that
a lot
really
of bullying,
awful.
And in the book, I call him Ricky. He was a gender nonconforming kid who also identified as gay. And by gender nonconforming, I mean that he sometimes wore hair extensions. He sometimes wore a little bit of makeup, sometimes wore some skirts over jeans. He was also far and away the school's most talented dancer, but he didn't dance like boys are supposed to dance. He did sort of the hip swivels and hand motions, et cetera, that girls did. So even though dancing was his favorite thing in the world, he didn't attend dances because, for instance, one time I was sitting in an auto shop and I was listening to boys talk about the homecoming dance.
Right.
And one boy said, oh, I hear Ricky's going to go in a skirt. And another boy said, oh, it's a hella short one. And another boy said, I won't even go if he's there. I'd just beat him up outside.
Whoa.
Right. So these threats of violence that undergirded his daily life, and he actually really shaped his life to avoid being the victim of violence. He would alter his home, route home from school each day. He'd always walk with a rock in his hand. He kept his eyes downcast so that he didn't meet other guys' eyes as if to challenge them to a fight. And he ended up dropping out of school because the school never protected him from those threats.
And when I was in high school, you could at least go home, right? You could at least like step away from the space that was a social space. And now we have Facebook, we have Twitter, we have all kinds of social media. We all know accounts where social media is used to bully people. Did you uncover stuff with that?
Yeah, well, social media is this really interesting thing. So when I was researching Dude,
right,
kids weren't online, right? So I was researching that in the early 2000s, right before the massive spread of high-speed internet access and the diffusion of cell phone ownership among teenagers. So I was largely looking at an offline world at that point. But the second book I wrote or co-authored, which was the Hanging Out, Messing Around, and Geeking Out book, was about what kids were doing with new media.
Right.
And literally in the space of this decade, right, the first decade of the 2000s, we saw kids going from being not wired to kids being totally wired. And so we see some interesting stuff in terms of bullying. on the one hand, you can see these studies that say, oh, you know, cyberbullying has increased, you know, exponential amounts. Well, of course it's increased exponential amounts because kids got online, right?
Right.
On the other hand, we do know that kids are still more likely to be bullied offline than they are online. So the real world still presents more threats. In part, what is happening with new media is that adults are starting – have this window into youth culture that they haven't had before. So the fights that would happen after school that only kids knew about and wouldn't necessarily tell their parents about are now put on YouTube, and parents are horrified. And it's not that those fights are new, but parents seeing them is something new, right? And so they get really scared about this technology as if the technology is facilitating the fights rather than just reflecting them. And I would say the other sort of interesting piece about new media is that it provides kids, you know, we take our kids and we don't like them to roam free, right? We like to confine them in these schools, these institutions. We put them in with these other people and we say, now be friends with them. Now get along with them, right? This group of people that we are assigning you to. And what the internet has done is allowed kids to be more agentic in choosing their own relationships.
Is there any positive outcomes from it in the sense of being able to find communities that you would, if you were like, say, in a very small town, which would be not available to you?
I'm so glad you asked that question because I very rarely get asked about the good parts of new media, right? Usually what I get asked about is, isn't it bad and destroying kids' brains? And I think what you're highlighting goes back to this point I was making earlier about how we sort of put kids in these little communities and like to control their movements. And what the online world does is it allows kids to reach beyond their immediate communities. And so we know that most kids' online worlds map largely onto their offline worlds, right? Their networks look relatively the same. But it does allow for them to move beyond these relatively confined spaces. And I found this to be true with racial ethnic minority kids, with sexual minority kids, and with kids who identify as genderqueer or transgendered. And it's true even in big cities, actually. I talked to one trans boy from New York City who said it was only online that he was able to find other kids like him and find a name for, he said, to find a name for what I was.
Dr. CJ Pascoe, thanks for being here today. You do fascinating and important work. Thank you for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. CJ Pascoe, author of Dude, You're a Fag, Masculinity and Sexuality in High School, and Hanging Out, Messing Around, and Geeking Out, Kids Living and Learning with New Media. So, Steve, how would you say that childhood has changed since you were a kid?
Well, I think that one of the ways that it's different is that children have a much wider field of experience than I did. I remember growing up in Richmond Hill, Ontario, and becoming very obsessed with the Dune books, you know, those Frank Herbert Dune Messiah. And I think I was well into my teens, maybe 17, 18, before I met another person who had even heard of Dune.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a different landscape for my kids, who are much more plugged in to popular culture than I was. There's all kinds of ways in which they belong to peer groups, whether it's gymnastics or the Lord of the Rings, you name it, that's far beyond their front door.
Right. So when you talk about popular culture and kids today being able to be plugged into it, not only things that are widely popular, but things that sort of exist in small niches in the world. So there may not be anyone in your immediate neighborhood who's interested in this, but kids can connect through the internet and find supportive communities in all sorts of ways. So do you remember Rubik's Cubes? Do you remember when they came out?
I have a vague, unpleasant recollection of Rubik's Cubes. It's always been I'm not the kind of person that is very good at Rubik's Cubes.
So the Rubik's Cubes have had an unbelievable evolution since the dinosaur
Rubik's
days.
Rubik's Cubes have evolved?
Rubik's Cubes have evolved in ways you can't even believe.
So we have the Lingyun V2, the Panshi, the Zanchi, the Guhong V2, the Fusion, the 55 millimeter Zanchi, 50 millimeter Zanchi, Lingyun, Guhong.
Craig, Jake, and I went to the Fountain Valley School to the Mile High Speed Cubing Tournament, which was held in the chapel there. And it was a really incredible experience learning so much about something that I really hadn't thought about for 35 years.
This is our third annual Colorado Springs Rubik's Cube competition. My name is Daniel Hayes. It's all about coming in and making things the same color as fast as you can. You know, we've got several different puzzles going on, and you know, that's about it. The quickest one wins.
These are speed cubers, is what
these
you call
are speed
them.
Cubers. So there were people there. It was an amazing group of people, from little kids, 7, 8 years old, all the way up through people in their teens, people in their 20s, and even older, who are seeing how fast they could solve the Rubik's Cube puzzle, doing it in a matter of seconds, actually.
My best time is 7.88 seconds.
11.39 seconds.
I did pretty well. My best time was a minute and 46 for a 4x4.
People doing it with one hand, doing it blindfolded. And it was an interesting community, because one of the things we saw was that they were, although they were competing with each other, they were a really supportive community. A lot of the people there are a little bit on the outside. There aren't a whole lot of people around in their immediate neighborhoods, for example, mm-hmm. who are really into cubing. So they find each other through the internet, and they connect with each other all the time. This is Helena Hosiung, whose son is an avid cuber.
From an early age, Jackson was communicating with other cubers who were in college, you know, adults all over the country, all over the world, people in Australia, Canada, and then they would get together at these competitions. It's really very collaborative and a very warm and good social opportunity, and often for people that aren't necessarily the social butterfly type, so a great way for them to connect and make friends.
Here's Jackson Morley, one of the organizers of the Mile High Speed Cubing Tournament.
A lot of the people I've met, like Daniel Hayes is here and AJ Blair, I've known for a long time, several years through it, and we only really see each other at competitions. So it's an interesting dynamic with that.
Diana Hartnett.
My son has taken it to I've allowed him to create a channel on YouTube, and he's connected with people from all over the world, and he has people that he's in contact with. They send videos back and forth and everything, and it's been a great social outlet for him.
So would you say then it's the opposite of this culture of competitiveness that surrounds us?
Well, I think certainly there was a culture of challenge, people wanting to do their best, score good times, see how fast they could solve this puzzle. But at the same time, people were very, very supportive of each other. And I think partly because it's something that doesn't get a whole lot of popular play or a popular support.
I don't know if it's the type of people that it attracts, or if it's the sense of community that we do afterwards. Because I think, like for example, in chess, after a chess meet, people don't sit around and play chess together, you know, in a light, friendly environment. After a cube tournament, we all go to dinner. We have our cubes out. We're playing, you know, playing with the cube. We're doing, you know, fun, stupid events that aren't official competition events that we can do together and that kind of thing.
I found myself thinking about that movie from about 20 years ago, Searching for Bobby Fischer, which, as you know, is all about competitive chess. And the one, what the scene that's repeated over and over again is, in the one room you have these children prodigies being very competitive about chess, and in the other room you have their parents freaking out. Is it like that?
That was really the mindset I had when I go in. Are there going to be the tiger parents there screaming at their kids, screaming at the other kids?
Sure.
What's going to be going on? That was completely not
really
what we found when we went there.
I've never seen any parental ugliness like Little League with cubing. Quite the opposite. You know, the cubers are all friends, and the parents really enjoy hanging out and socializing at the competitions too.
So it seems to me that this really is an example that runs counter to a lot of the ways in which we think about competition and childhood and the corrosive effects that it can have.
Right. And in many ways, this is almost a utopian community. It's a supportive community. It's a solid community. It's a community that has competition in it, but also comradeship.
Speed cubing is a kind of ideal childhood interstitial space, almost.
It's certainly, and at the Mile High Cubing Club, at the Mile High Cubing Tournament that we attended, that's what it seemed like to me.
Did you pick up any pointers on it, on how to do the cube?
Well, this is the thing I realized, is that some people are good at this and some people are good at throwing cubes long distances. And I'm in the second category.
I'm Steve Hayward, and this is Off Topic.
I'm Kathy Giffray, and this week we're talking about childhood.
I had a recent experience of a surprising experience about a book that I thought was going to be age-appropriate for my 9-year-old. And the book was Peter Pan. Have you read Peter Pan?
I have read Peter Pan.
Have you read it recently?
I have not read it recently, although I did watch it on TV recently.
It's a terrific book. It was just turned out to be a very different book than the one that I had recollected. And this experience of coming back to Peter Pan, that I realized that I had constructed Peter Pan, misremembered Peter Pan, in much the same way as one constructs and misremembers one's own childhood, to make it a much more simpler, much more rosy thing that maybe it was.
And Peter Pan didn't start off as a book, right? It started off as a play.
And before it was a play, it was enclosed within a different book, a much more adult book, a context that was much more ambiguous than anything most of us know about. We brought in Professor George Butte. He's a English professor. He's at work right now on a study of Peter Pan. He talked to us about the textual history of Peter Pan, which turned out to be a lot more complicated than we might have thought.
But Peter, how do we get to Neverland?
Fly, of course.
Fly?
It's easy.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the publication history of Peter Pan? It's an autonomous text to begin with, right?
Correct. Initially, it was published actually privately by James Barry for the family that he knew, the Llewellyn Davies boys. But its first public appearance was in a very grown up book called The Little White Bird, which was a bestseller in 1902. But it was a fantasy piece offered as a kind of seduction to a little boy inside the story, by a bachelor uncle. Mm-hmm. And so it was not at all a child's piece on its own. It was performed, if you will, as a child's piece for an adult audience. But it was published as a novella in 1911. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece that a lot of people try to read to their kids. It's a very strange book because it is a novel with a narrator who makes all kinds of comments about children, about parents, that a lot of people found and still find quite inappropriate.
What is it that would make us wonder today?
Well, in the novella, what happens is that there's a narrator who comments on children and adults and life, and those narrator comments are edited out.
Mm-hmm.
There are also some elements of the story. Peter, in the original, is quite heartless. He forgets Wendy's name when they're flying back to Neverland. He's a deeply narcissistic character, quite cold at heart. And some of those episodes are softened. But typically, it's simply the narrator's voice is taken away, and Peter becomes much more sentimental and sweet.
So, all right, let's hear a little bit, if you don't mind, of that of Barry's initial novella, kind of thing that is edited out of those cleaned up sort of middle of the road Peter Pans that we're likely to encounter.
Exactly. Here's the final line of the book, which is used in movies and widely, and it's often the implications are avoided. When Margaret grows up, she will have a daughter who is to be Peter's mother in turn. And thus it will go on so long as children are gay and innocent and heartless.
Right.
Most people ignore the heartless, but that's exactly what Barry says over and over again, that these that Peter doesn't care. He's a cold and sad and lonely boy.
Yeah.
And you see that over and over.
When you read that piece, it makes me wonder about the kind of idea of the child that you find in Peter Pan, which is odd because we think of it as being a celebration of childhood. He doesn't want to grow up. And it's very different though, isn't it? For Barry, childhood is all about being narcissistic, all about being selfish, all about being, and that word again, right. Heartless.
Right, and callous, absolutely. And not to grow up is also a sort of tragic dimension for Peter. Really, it's a lose-lose situation. It's sad if you grow up, and it's sad if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
That dilemma is presented with humor at times and with wit and whimsy, but that's the underlying core. There's a line from another essay that Barry wrote that I love to quote: "To be born is to be wrecked upon an island."
To be born is to be wrecked upon an island. Not exactly an optimistic view
right,
of childhood.
Right, exactly.
One of the things that one wonders when reading Peter Pan, or when attempting to read, I think that a lot of people try. I think it's a very common experience to attempt to read the text. It raises the whole question of what we're talking about when we talk about children's literature, about the possibility of children's literature. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a great question. And the issues are quite complicated because children's literature as a form has been thought about quite a bit recently, with a lot of interesting angles that people have raised. One of the great dilemmas in thinking about children's literature is it's very hard to know what children themselves really want or would write,
mm-hmm.
because, in fact, children's literature is written by adults. It is purchased, that is, acquired by agents for publishers who are adults. The editors at publishing houses are adults. The marketers are adults. And I think many, many people writing for children sincerely want to address what they think of as children's needs.
And want to sell books.
Right, both. But I won't be too cynical about it. They certainly want to address the child, but they cannot do so without the filter of their adult consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no way of knowing what a 4 or 5-year-old really wants. But part of the goal of writing for the 4 or 5-year-old is to shape the 4 or 5-year-old that you want to shape as an adult, thinking that this is the way a child should grow up.
So in other words, children's literature is a kind of blank screen upon which we project our ideas of what a child is, our idealizations
right.
of childhood.
Correct.
As a parent, one struggles with the question about children's literature. Do we look for the most sanitized, the most idealized kind of literature, or do we say the world is an ambiguous, traumatic place? Let us find and let us expose our children to a children's literature that is ambiguous, that is traumatic.
It's a great issue to think about, and think about it particularly also these days in relation to film, TV shows, what's age appropriate. But one answer to that dilemma was offered by Bruno Bettelheim, mm-hmm. a famous psychoanalyst who wrote about children's tales and fairy tales. He felt that there would be a place for trauma and sadness, but the stories always had to end happily. So there was a resolution to the struggle. And that's, again, why Barry's Peter Pan is so disturbing, because the resolution is not there. But one middle ground, I mean, I think the 2-year-old, 3-year-old, you don't read stories of abandonment and loss. But at some point, you begin to introduce stories with more serious threats and more monsters.
Mm-hmm.
But there are happy endings. There are resolutions to the dilemma.
Mm-hmm. And it's a world that makes sense because of that
right.
Resolution. Listen, George, thanks for being with us. This has been a fascinating discussion. come back again and talk to us.
Okay, thank you, Stephen.
Think of a wonderful thought, any merry little thought. Think of Christmas, think of snow, think of sleigh bells, off you go like reindeer in the sky. You can fly, you can fly, you can fly.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Jaffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
That was Professor George Butte talking to us about the strange and really surprising career of Peter Pan as a piece of literature.
In an odd way, Peter Pan is, I think, a fictional construct, a character who really speaks to something about our times, about the redefinition of childhood, the ways in which it seems, to me at least, that children or adulthood is getting increasingly distant.
Adulthood is getting increasingly fraught and complicated, and it's something that, you know, we look at it and it seems so difficult to do. Adulthood seems so difficult to do that the idea that you would stay a child, that you would be Peter Pan, stay a child forever, has a certain appeal to it.
We talked to Dr. Nick Santilli, a developmental psychologist based in Cleveland, about precisely this kind of interstitial space. It's a developmental category he calls emerging adulthood.
15 or so years ago, a researcher named Jeffrey Arnett coined the term emerging adulthood to capture the life stage between age 18 and 25. What this really is focused on in terms of this particular life stage and why this isn't young adulthood, which really starts around 25, as Arnett argues, is that the period of 18 to 25 in most westernized or industrial cultures is still a period of time of prolonged transition to full-fledged adulthood. If we look at the kinds of things that 18 to 25-year-olds are doing, many of them are continuing on in post-secondary education. Certainly that's not characteristic of all, but it's characteristic of many in these environments. So they're gaining more training, preparation. Also, there is a broader sense of personal development at this time. Arnett describes this life stage is characterized as continuing identity development, a period of time of self-focus where individuals have a time to be far more self-reflective in environments that are relatively safe, like the college environment for the traditional residential college student. They have opportunities to explore possibilities. In many ways, they feel a sense of lack of connection because they haven't made these type of personal commitments that were more common, like the kinds of commitments that were more common for individuals in the 50s and 60s in particular. When you look at, the common trajectory is unless you were going off into a profession, most individuals exited high school moving into a job and living in their own home, and many of them getting married in their early 20s. Now the average age of first marriage is much later these days.
To what extent is this category of emergent adulthood linked to the extent to which we over-supervise and mollycoddle our children? To what extent does that have to do with the ways in which we don't get to experience childhood as a space of exploration today in this very supervised world that we live in?
In terms of thinking about the overscheduling of kids' lives, and how much of that really begins to occur, where we're shuttling kids to more and more structured activities that are arranged or organized by adults, and not really giving kids opportunities to arrange and structure their own activities. Thinking about how are we taking away from them social skill development, especially in the present context when we worry that kids, the only way kids talk to each other these days is by texting each other. Are they really negotiating conflicts, and how are they doing those kinds of things? And, of course, in the higher ed world, you and I are very well aware of what we've called over the years the helicopter parent, intruding into every aspect of their son's or daughter's college experience. Some individuals in the student affairs area now talk about the snowplow and lawnmower parents. The snowplow parent is the parent who's out in front of their kid knocking everything out of their way to clear the path, or the lawnmower parent just hovering closer to the ground than the helicopter. So the hyper-intrusive. And recently there were some articles in the New York Times in the past several years seeing this being extended to the first job individual, son or daughter is applying for. Parents negotiating the contract and the salary for their sons and daughters, or at least trying to. So, we've seen it here in higher ed for a little while, and now it's beginning to spread into other parts of the individual's life. The other thing is also the nature of rewarding. If we think about the kinds of expectations that, in our environment in college, our students have regarding a grade, they come in and appeal a grade because they think they deserve an A because they came to every class. I remember the first time I went to my son, was playing soccer, the first youth league in the community, walked into the year-end celebration, and there were tables and tables lined up with trophies. This was about 20 years ago when kids get participation trophies.
Yeah, and in our day, people, the winner, if you won, you got a trophy, and if you did, you slunked away in defeat. And there was something good about that. There was something good about the experience of adversity.
That's where, and I think that's some of the things that we're seeing with some of the fragility of individuals, in their late teens into their early 20s. If we look at the literature that we see that's done on the mental health of college students, and you talk with individuals who are directors of counseling centers on college campuses that talk about the increasing number of students coming in with diagnosed anxiety disorders or depressive disorders and on medication, also having achievement anxiety because of the pressure the parents are placing upon them, especially those of us who work in private institutions, parents saying, I'm not paying, $40,000 a year for you to go off and study philosophy. You need to get a job. And that kind of pressure that students have creates a lot of anxiety and stress in their lives. And again, sort of thinking about, this parental pressure and structure and in some ways intrusion of parents into students' lives that creates this interpersonal dynamic where we see students seemingly unfocused, not finishing things that they start, don't know how to cope with the minor, stress of not getting the class they wanted at the time they wanted, those kinds of things. And, that's where we're falling down on teaching them the kind of coping strategies that confronting adversity, when you've got to negotiate with another kid what game you're going to play when you're five, it ends up blowing up in the extreme sense that if we continue doing that, that they're unable to pick a decent schedule when they're college students or, figure out what they want to do with their lives when those moments come.
Nick, thanks so much for talking with us. I appreciate your time, and thanks so much.
No problem. My pleasure.
I am a child. I last a while. You can't conceive of the pleasure in my smile.
This is Off Topic. I'm Kathy Giffray.
I'm Steve Hayward.
It seems that this idea of childhood is only one aspect here. There are children and there are also parents. And in this, extended childhood, there's a question of how the parents are reacting to all this, or maybe how the parents are shaping.
Yeah, how the parents are producing a certain version of childhood.
In our discussion with Dr. Stephen Mintz from the University of Texas, this is one of the things that came up, the connection between childhood and parenting, how those two things work together. So it seems there's sort of a tension here in this prolongation of juvenile life, of the juvenile time period between the sort of putting four-year-olds down in coal mines because they're so small and they fit nicely in the crevices.
Right.
And having kids who are 18 years old and don't know how to, say, do their own laundry.
We, I would argue, have, in a sense, juvenilized kids. If you read biographies from the 19th century, one is greatly surprised to discover that kids did things at ages that we would generally view as inconceivable. That is, Abraham Lincoln, at the age of 2, helps his father clear fields when the family moves from Kentucky to Indiana. Mark Twain's father dies when he's 12, and he then goes to work as a printer's apprentice in New York City. Washington, D.C., St. Louis, and Keokuk, Iowa. It would be very, very difficult for us to imagine putting our kids through the same kind of experience, unsheltered and alone. Herman Melville's father went insane and then died around the time he was 12, and so Herman Melville was sent off on a whaling ship and was literally, he jumped ship and was taken captive by cannibals. He got wonderful material for his books from this experience. But again, and this was all by the time he was 18. This is just extraordinary to us. This sense the kids are more resilient and far more capable than we think. So for most young people, they do not get a chance to really demonstrate their growing maturity, their growing competence, their growing abilities. And it's not surprising if you place kids in a world where they can't show their maturity, that they don't act as maturely as you would wish.
Right. Tell me one last question. The title of your book, Huck's Raft, can you explain the significance of that for us?
We in our country have a fantasy about childhood, that it should be a time of play, a carefree period of fantasy and imagination, a time of exploration and discovery, a real odyssey that each of us goes on our own or in connection with our friends. But that vision of childhood has, in my view, increasingly become a fantasy. It's not a reality. But I would argue that you and I, acting collectively, have the ability to create that world, and that there would be no greater gift that we could give our children who never asked to be brought into this world. There's no greater gift we could give them than to transform childhood into what our fantasy tells us it should be, an odyssey of self-discovery.
This is Off Topic. I'm Steve Hayward.
I'm Kathy Jaffray. We've been talking about childhood, and it seems that the concept of childhood is much more complicated and actually much more malleable than we had originally thought.
And just to circle back, Kathy, to the question with which we started, do you think it has changed that much, that all of this discussion, whether we're talking about helicopter parents, whether we're talking about snowplow parents, whether we're talking about Peter Pan, whether they're talking about Rubik's Cube, to what extent does it really make a difference?
I mean, Stephen Mintz tells us that certainly adult conceptions of childhood were radically different, say, 400 years ago than they are now. But I think the question you're asking is from the perspective of the child, not from the adult putting childhood into a category and objectifying this concept. Is there something essential about the nature of being a child?
I think the question of whether that has a satisfying answer or a right answer is really beside the point. That when we think about childhood, it's as much about framing the question of asking not what does childhood mean, but what do we mean by childhood.
Off Topic is a collaboration of KRCC and the Colorado College, produced by Craig Richardson and Jake Brownell at the Tim Gill Center for Public Media.
For more information or to stream this or any other of our episodes, you can follow us at offtopicradio.org. You've got to kill my dog.